Chapter 12. Things began to go drastically wrong sooner even than Jack could have hoped. Hardly anyone went to bed in a very good mood that night, and William, of course, did not go to bed at all. Rosie was dissatisfied with her portrait, and wondering whether her first instinct, that Mrs. Fosdyke was unpaintable, had not been the right one. Tess had, by 10 o'clock, transcribed only 34 out of a total of 2,094 pages of Voltaire, and had writer's cramp. Mrs. Bagthorpe had not been able to concentrate on her problems for worrying about the possibility of William's either going into an irreversible trance, or emerging at any moment as a whirling dervish. Mr. Bagthorpe had been unable to concentrate on his script because he maintained that William's tattoo was already beginning to build up, as he described it, in his study. "My own brain has already become as a skin drum," he declared, "and in the night my subconscious mind will be insidiously invaded. The very citadel of my creativity is under attack." He was so constantly asserting, without any supporting evidence, that he was about to dry up forever as a writer, that none of the family took much notice of this. They felt he was at least as well off as they were themselves. The only members of the household who had retired in good humor, Jack himself was in a neutral state of mind, were Grandma and Daisy. This in itself was hardly an encouraging sign for the rest of them, as the unholy alliance tended to appear at its most benign, when at its most destructive. "Daisy and I will set about becoming immortal tomorrow," Grandma told them all. "Doubly immortal, I should say. We have hit upon a most symbolic and poetic way of achieving this." Even Mrs. Bagthorpe did not much like the sound of this. The last time Daisy had been poetic and symbolic, the entire house had had to be redecorated. "With Arioch helping?" she inquired anxiously. "Certainly not," replied Grandma promptly. "He might," Daisy said. "If I need him, I'll ask him." "You leave him out of it," Mr. Bagthorpe advised her. "You realize, don't you, that you are on the verge of bankrupting your father?" "Hush, Henry," his wife said. "Remember what we promised Celia." "I made no promises to anyone," he said. "Mother did all the promising, and even she was not aware at the time that we should also be entertaining Arioch, I believe." "Any friend of Daisy's is a friend of mine," said Grandma obstinately. She wholeheartedly detested Arioch, and was extremely jealous of him, but she did not wish to risk alienating Daisy, and in any case liked to needle her son whenever possible. "I'm taking William his sausages," Daisy then announced, "so he doesn't get into a skellington." With this, she accordingly left the room, and returned a few minutes later with a request for 2 large slices of cake. Mr. Bagthorpe was against this being granted. "It might be our only chance," he said, "to starve him out." Daisy, however, insisted. "I'm going to get a secret if I do it," she said. The cake was therefore sent up, arriving, albeit a little frayed around the edges, where, Daisy informed an accusatory William, Arioch had been nibbling at it. When Jack awoke the following morning, the first thing he noticed was that the drums had stopped. His room was directly beneath William's, and on one or two occasions during the night he had awakened and been momentarily aware of the throb of drums overhead. He even remembered having wondered whether Zero, with his acute sense of hearing, might be affected by this. The next thing Jack became conscious of was voices raised to a pitch remarkable even by Bagthorpian standards. Picking up his clock, he saw that the time was just before 7. Zero was still asleep. A particularly high-pitched burst of screaming from Daisy brought Jack leaping out of bed and onto the landing. Here was taking place a full-scale furor between Bagthorpes in various stages of undress. William and Mr. Bagthorpe were both in their pajamas and both shouting. Daisy, clinging to Grandma's nightdress, was sobbing bitterly. Rosie was trying to make her own voice heard above the others, and Mrs. Bagthorpe, her hair in madly swinging plaits, was vainly trying to arbitrate, or referee. 16 hours! Jack heard William shout. "Don't talk to me about 16 hours," yelled Mr. Bagthorpe. "I know how long it's been, and for God's sake, stop shouting." "It serves you right," screamed Rosie. "Daisy's only little. You're a bully, a great horrible bully." In a miraculous hiatus, which could have occurred only by everyone present simultaneously pausing to draw breath, Grandma said coldly, "I think I know a storm in a teacup when I see one. Come, Daisy, we will have no part of it. We have our own affairs to attend to." With this, she withdrew into her room, taking Daisy with her, and closed the door. Mrs. Bagthorpe took advantage of the resulting stunned silence to say, with an attempt at cheerfulness, "Come along, everybody. Let's go down to the kitchen and make coffee and talk about the whole thing sensibly." They went down to the kitchen and made coffee, but practically nobody talked sensibly. It was some time before everyone present had a clear picture of what it was they were all shouting about. What had happened emerged only gradually, partly because just as everyone was beginning to calm down, Grandma and Daisy reappeared. Grandma could never resist a row. "Daisy has confided in me what part she played in this ridiculous charade," she announced, "and her case must be represented. I will not tolerate her being slandered in her absence." What had happened then was this. Fact the first. William, having been conscientiously beating his tattoo through the long lonely hours of the night, had hit bottom around dawn. He had run out of food and drink, he said, and was feeling faint. He had not felt that his mother would want to find him lying unconscious in his room when she came up to investigate, and had stopped his tattoo while he decided on his best course of action. Fact the second. As he sat, thus faintly ruminating, Daisy had poked her head into the room. Daisy was a notoriously early riser, a fact that Aunt Celia attributed to an overpowerful brain, but about which the Bagthorpes had their own theories. She had inquired why he had stopped drumming, and on being told the reason had offered to fetch food and drink. William had considered this proposition, but turned it down. He had not, he explained, thought it wise or public-spirited to give Daisy the unsupervised freedom of the kitchen or pantry. "She might have set fire to it, or flooded it," he said, "or mixed everything together to make an explosion." Grandma instantly objected to this and ruled it out of order. "That is merely supposition," she told William. "You are alleging a purely hypothetical crime. You are leading the jury. Kindly limit yourself to the facts." Sometimes Grandma found her addiction to television police serials paid off handsomely. At this, Mr. Bagthorpe pointed out that the present jury was hopelessly prejudiced anyway, and any false hopes of fair play or justice could be ruled out right away. William had thought, he continued, that he owed it to his mother to go down and get food, even though he realized that this might take longer than the 15-minute authorized break. "And you hoped nobody would know," Rosie cried. "You thought we were all asleep and wouldn't hear, and you were cheating." "I was doing nothing of the sort," he retorted. "I was jeopardizing my chance of a record, certainly, but I hope to be back at my drums within 15 minutes."
"Oh, you fibber!"
Rosie jumped up and fetched the frying pan and brandished it under his nose, thereby splashing warm fat over her mother.
"You were frying bacon and egg. We can smell it. We're not deaf, you know."
William went very red, and tried to bluster his way out of the situation by saying he had realized that the fry-up would take too long, and snatched up some bread and marmalade instead. "Where, in that case, is the bacon?" cried Grandma triumphantly. As defense counsel, she felt she had him there. "And what we're talking about," he went on, using the time-honored tactic of attack as the best form of defense, "isn't what I had to eat, but what happened to my drums." Fact the third. Daisy, when William declared his intention of going downstairs to forage for food, pleaded to be allowed to continue the tattoo in his absence. To this request, William had replied with a firm negative. Having no real reason to trust Daisy, he had taken the precaution of bearing the drumsticks away with him, thus thinking to render her helpless. Daisy, however, was not thus easily rendered helpless. fact the fourth. Daisy at first contented herself with fingering the drums, in itself a new experience because William, as a rule, would allow her nowhere near them. Her initial curiosity satisfied, she then tried to beat out a little rhythm with her fingers. "I was trying to do John Brown's body," she told them, "but my fingers is too little. They didn't make any banging." Bagthorpe blood undeniably ran in Daisy's veins, and she did not give up. Casting around her for a suitable substitute for a drumstick, her eye fell upon a plate, knife, and fork.
Oh,